Hello, I'm Greg Stone from Columbia University Medical Center and the Cardiovascular Research Foundation in New York. And today we're going to talk about clinical trial interpretation, specifically what to do when the primary endpoint of a clinical trial is positive. Is that enough evidence to either adopt a new therapy or to change clinical practice? And this is going to be a review or a synthesis of about 50% of a two-part article that Stuart Pocock and I recently wrote and published in the New England Journal of Medicine on how to interpret clinical trials. So there's a natural tendency to assess the results of randomized clinical trials as either positive or negative, according to whether the p-value for the primary outcome measure is less than or greater than 0.05. However, such an interpretation is really overly simplistic. The primary endpoint result is just a starting point in the comprehensive evaluation of the totality of the clinical evidence, which includes consideration of secondary endpoints, safety issues, and the size and the quality of a trial. So today we're going to talk about how to assess a clinical study where the primary outcome is positive, p-value of less than 0.05. That's good news, but believe it or not, that's essentially necessary for a clinical trial to be positive in most cases, but it's really not sufficient. There's 11 key questions that we suggest that you need to ask when the primary outcome is positive to know whether it's positive enough. And here's the long list. So instead of reading all of these 11, I'm going to give you examples that we went over in depth in the New England Journal of Medicine article. So first, is a p-value less than 0.05 strong enough evidence to adopt a new therapy? Well, you have to realize that a p of 0.05 represents about a 5% risk of a false positive result. And proof beyond a reasonable doubt requires a much smaller p-value, for example, less than 0.001. So a p-value of 0.01 to 0.049 is some evidence that the trial is positive, but it's not really conclusive. So, for example, you take the PARADIGM-HF trial of a new neprilysin inhibitor, an angiotensin receptor blocker, versus enalapril in more than 8,000 patients with heart failure. And looking at the primary endpoint of cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalization, the new agent reduced that endpoint by 20% compared to control. The p-value is less than 0.001, and in addition, there were also individual reductions in all-cause death, cardiovascular death, and heart failure hospitalizations, each of which were also less than 0.001. This is really overwhelming evidence of benefit, and therefore regulatory approval, both in the United States and Europe, came from this single randomized trial. Now, in contrast, you could take the SAINT-1 trial of a free radical trapping agent versus placebo in about 1,700 patients with acute ischemic stroke. The primary endpoint was the modified Rankin score disability at 90 days. And if you look at the overall distribution, there was some evidence of benefit. The p-value was 0.038 by the Cochrane-Mantel-Hansel test, suggesting that there was about a 20% odds ratio of improvement in MRS disability scores. But this in and of itself, with that p-value just barely less than 0.05, was not enough for regulatory approval. And the regulators said, we need more data, do a larger trial. So they ran the SAINT-2 trial, almost an identical trial, but now in 3,306 patients with acute ischemic stroke with a very similar endpoint, and now the p-value is 0.33. It is now a negative trial, and as a result, the conclusion was that this new agent was ineffective for acute ischemic stroke. So the regulators were right in saying that just wasn't enough evidence, we needed more. Second point, and this is very important, is the magnitude of the treatment benefit clinically relevant? The more and more patients you study, the more likely you might demonstrate a clinical benefit if one is true, but if it's a very, very small clinical benefit, then it may not be worth the cost or potential complications. And in this case, it's helpful to consider the absolute treatment effects as well as the relative treatment effects, for example, a number needed to treat analysis. So, for example, the classic now example is that of IMPROVE-IT, ezetimibe versus placebo in nearly 18,000 patients with acute coronary syndromes, treated with a background of simvastatin in both arms. The primary endpoint of cardiovascular death, MI, unstable angina, revascularization, or stroke was reduced by adding ezetimibe to simvastatin, but it was a 6% reduction. The p-value was 0.02, and it took 7 years for this to become positive. And over that seven-year period, there was a 2% absolute difference in event rates. That's about 0.3% per year. So it's fair to ask, is the benefit of ezetimibe large enough to warrant its cost and potential complications? And an FDA advisory panel voted no. Third point, is the primary outcome clinically important? And there are several ways to look at this. First, you have to consider the issue of surrogate endpoints. To make trials smaller, we often use surrogate endpoints, that is, not clinical endpoints, but other mechanistic or biochemical measures that often correlate with the improved clinical outcome. For example, hemoglobin A1C is a measure of diabetic control. And the ACCORD trial was a study of intensive versus standard glucose-lowering therapy in more than 10,000 patients with type 2 diabetes. And the intensive therapy markedly reduced hemoglobin A1C. There's no doubt about this, and the p-value less than 0.0001. On the other hand, the primary endpoint of cardiovascular death, MI, or stroke was not significantly improved, and in fact, mortality was increased. So this shows you can't always rely, in fact, often you cannot rely on surrogate endpoints. We really need clinical evidence of benefit before we adopt new therapies. You also have to look very carefully at composite clinical endpoints, because the reason we use composite endpoints, even when they are clinically based, is to reduce sample size. But this assumes that the mechanism of benefit for each of the composite components is the same and that they'll all go in the same direction. So, for example, if you look at the EXPEDITION trial, an intravenous sodium hydrogen exchange inhibitor, cariparide, in patients undergoing bypass surgery, the primary endpoint of death or MI at 5 days was significantly reduced with this new agent. But you have to look at the components. And in fact, mortality was increased while myocardial infarction was decreased. So obviously, the increase in mortality does not warrant adopting this drug. Point four, are secondary outcomes supportive? Confidence in the totality of the evidence is enhanced if pre-specified secondary outcomes are positive in addition to the primary endpoint. So, for example, I told you about the SAINT-1 trial of a free radical trapping agent versus placebo in acute ischemic stroke. And I told you that the modified Rankin score was borderline positive in this first trial, a p-value of 0.08. But there were other secondary endpoints, such as the NIHS stroke score and the Barthel Index, both of which were negative. And this was additional reason to want more data to rather than just approving the trial on the basis of its primary endpoint. So the primary endpoint was mildly positive, but secondary endpoints were not, raising doubts and reinforcing the need for a second larger trial. And you already saw that second larger trial was negative. Now, in contrast, look at the EMPA-REG outcome of empagliflozin versus placebo in 7,000 patients with type 2 diabetes. Here, the primary endpoint was CV death, MI, or stroke at a median follow-up of 3 years. And here, there was borderline evidence of efficacy. You could see a reduction in 1.6%, a p-value of 0.04. But when you look at other pre-specified endpoints, cardiovascular death, all-cause mortality, and heart failure hospitalizations, these were all strongly reduced in favor of the new agent. So these secondary endpoints now lend credence to the utility and benefit of that borderline primary endpoint. Point five, are the findings consistent across important subgroups? You have to be very careful when interpreting subgroups because spurious findings can arise when multiple subgroups are analyzed. Nonetheless, we can learn a lot from looking at subgroups, especially if biologic plausibility is present. Now, a great example of this was the PLATO trial of ticagrelor versus clopidogrel in more than 18,000 patients with acute coronary syndromes. And if you look at the primary endpoint of CV death, MI, or stroke at 3-year follow-up, most subgroups were very positive except for one. And here, it was depending on the chronic dose of aspirin that was used. If aspirin was used at a low dose, that is less than 300 milligrams, then the benefit of ticagrelor in terms of reducing ischemic events was very, very robust. But in a relatively small subgroup of patients that had a high dose of aspirin used, there was actually harm in using ticagrelor. And the interaction between these two relative risks was very, very strongly positive, well less than 0.0001. Now, no one's been able to figure out the biologic plausibility of this, but because it was so strong, the FDA actually put a boxed warning when it approved ticagrelor, saying that if you are going to use ticagrelor, that you have to chronically use a low dose of aspirin, and they recommended less than 100 milligrams. Now, a very important point is number 6. Is the trial large enough to be convincing? Small trials lack power, and positive treatment effects are susceptible to exaggeration. False positives can occur. That's called type 1 error. So you need a large trial, usually a multi-center trial, to be convincing. So for example, there was a well-known randomized trial of N-acetylcysteine versus placebo to prevent contrast nephropathy, which was performed in 83 patients with chronic kidney disease. And here, as published in the New England Journal of Medicine, there was a 90% reduction in contrast nephropathy with N-acetylcysteine. And this led to the conclusion in the journal that N-acetylcysteine prevents the reduction in renal function induced by iopramide. Now, in retrospect, this is much too strong a claim. A 90% treatment effect is really not biologically plausible. Almost nothing has such a great treatment effect. And subsequently, meta-analysis of multiple, also small to moderate size, N-acetylcysteine randomized controlled trials have not consistently shown efficacy. In retrospect, and I think the journal would do this today, a better conclusion would be that N-acetylcysteine may reduce contrast nephropathy based on this unreasonably large treatment effect, which would have prompted more confirmatory trials. You also have to ask, was the trial stopped early if it's positive? And it could be stopped early because of slow recruitment. And now you have to be very careful because of selection bias. It may not be a representative population that was studied. But you also have to be careful it was stopped early because of markedly positive interim results. In this case, it is not uncommon to stop on what's called a random high. So if, for example, the truth is a 30% reduction, as you're rolling the dice to get to that 30% reduction, in other words, studying a small number of patients, some of the early data may come in at 20% reduced, 5% reduced, or 50% reduced, or 60% reduced. And trials often stop early because of a marked treatment benefit. And usually you're stopping higher than is the actual truth. Now, a good example is the FAME-2 trial of PCI versus medical therapy in patients with positive fractional flow reserve lesions consistent with ischemia. The primary endpoint was death MI or urgent revascularization, and this trial was stopped early by the Data Safety and Monitoring Board after only 888 patients were enrolled because of overwhelming evidence of benefit. But when you look to see what components actually drove the benefit, it was primarily urgent revascularization, which you can argue is a relatively soft outcome in an unblinded trial. In contrast, death or myocardial infarction was not significantly reduced, but there was a trend towards a reduction. And had this trial been allowed to go to its natural completion, the reduction in death or MI might have become significant, which would have added a great deal of benefit to this study. A very, very important point when you're trying to analyze a positive primary endpoint is to look not only at efficacy, but the opposite arm, which is safety. Do safety concerns counterbalance positive efficacy? And in this regard, you need to consider the absolute benefits and risks. You have to consider the number needed to treat for benefit versus the number needed to harm for a safety concern. And this may provide a guide to net clinical benefit. So let's take two examples. For example, the SPRINT trial of intensive versus standard blood pressure control in over 9,000 patients with moderate hypertension. And you can see here that there was anywhere from 0.6% to 1.6% absolute reduction with intensive blood pressure control in MACE, cardiovascular death, and severe heart failure. Now, counterbalancing these benefits were anywhere from a 0.6% to 1.6% increase in hypotension, syncope, electrolyte abnormalities, and acute renal insufficiency. So how do you know whether patients overall benefited or were harmed by this therapy? Well, perhaps the overall arbiter is absolute mortality, and in this trial, there was a highly statistically significant reduction in absolute mortality by 1.2%. So number needed to treat was approximately 90 to 95 to save one life. So therefore, the net effect of intensive blood pressure control is beneficial if intolerable side effects don't occur. In contrast, let's look at the DAPT trial of 12 versus 30 months of clopidogrel in 9,661 aspirin-treated patients after a drug-eluting stent. So this is extended dual antiplatelet therapy. And here, there was clear ischemic benefit with anywhere from a 1 to 2% absolute reduction in MACE, stent thrombosis, and myocardial infarction. Now, we have to weigh that against the risks of increasing major bleeding. So do patients overall benefit or harm? Well, if you look here, there was no significant difference in cardiovascular death, but both non-cardiovascular death and all-cause mortality were actually increased. So this was a borderline increase, though, of 0.05. Was this chance, or is this a real net clinical harm to these patients? So, of course, the controversy has now ensued. Is the net effect of prolonging DAPT beneficial, harmful, or net neutral? And then finally, or near finally, are there flaws in trial design or conduct? If the results are strongly positive, you have to consider whether there were biases in trial design or conduct before you can accept that there is a genuine benefit. So, for example, the Simplicity Hypertension 2 of renal denervation in resistant hypertension was markedly positive, suggesting that this therapy reduces blood pressure. But this was an open-label trial, and that can introduce placebo effects, Hawthorne effects, ascertainment bias, and all other sorts of issues. And this was subsequently then supplanted by the Simplicity Hypertension 3 sham controlled trial of renal denervation in 535 patients with resistant hypertension, showing no significant reduction in blood pressure. And the control arm had a significant reduction in addition to the treatment arm, again showing how powerful both the placebo effect and Hawthorne effects might be. So blinding trials is very, very important to eliminate bias. Also, you could look at another study, such as the ATLAS ACS2 TIMI-51 trial of rivaroxaban versus placebo in more than 15,000 patients with acute coronary syndromes. This was a positive trial. There was a 16% relative reduction in the hazard of the CV death, MI, or stroke at two-year follow-up. However, almost 28% of the patients discontinued the treatment early, 8% withdrew consent, and 7.2% had missing vital status. And due to this uncertainty, the FDA did not grant an indication for ACS to this agent. Finally, you have to ask, do the findings apply to your patients? You must carefully examine not only the inclusion criteria, but also the characteristics of the patients actually enrolled, their background therapies, and the geographies of practice to determine if the results are relevant. So, for example, intensive versus standard blood pressure lowering. In the SPRINT trial, there was a reduction of death or heart failure, but the SPRINT trial excluded patients with diabetes. In contrast, the ACCORD BP trial was a very similar trial, but just in patients with type 2 diabetes. Here, there was no reduction in mortality or in heart failure, but there was a reduction in stroke. So now the question comes up, are these varying results due to differences in patient characteristics, trial methods, background therapies, chance, or other factors? You also have to be careful in this regard about single-center trials. They must be viewed very cautiously. There are center-specific effects, such as particular systems of care and background therapies used, which may not be relevant to many other centers. This precludes generalizability. Single-center trials also often lack quality control measures. So results from single-center trials, even those with a reasonable sample size, should rarely serve as the basis for changing guidelines unless validated in subsequent multi-center trials. For example, we all remember the TAPIS trial, a single-center trial of more than 1,000 patients of thrombus aspiration during primary PCI and STEMI. It showed a very substantial and impressive reduction in mortality at 1 year with thromboaspiration. Now, the primary endpoint of this trial was improved ST segment resolution and myocardial blush, which were modestly improved with thrombus aspiration. And there was no reduction in infarct size in terms of suggesting a mechanism that might reduce mortality. Nonetheless, this therapy was widely adopted and ultimately led to two very large outcomes trials, TASTE and TOTAL, in more than 17,000 patients, and these two trials showed no clinical benefit for routine use of thrombus aspiration. So beware, again, this is an unreasonable treatment effect. There was no mechanistic or plausible benefit, and be very careful about single-center trials, in this case, underpowered for mortality reduction. Finally, you have to ask, by the time the trial has been reported, has the experimental treatment been surpassed by new therapies, and therefore it may not be relevant to the way you practice? Good examples would be the Syntax and the Freedom trial, which demonstrated superiority of bypass surgery to first-generation drug-eluting stents. But since then, there had been multiple studies, for example, of newer contemporary stents, for example, fluoropolymer-based everolimus-eluting stents, suggesting compared to paclitaxel-eluting stents or demonstrating reductions in both ischemic TLR, showing better efficacy, and stent thrombosis, showing better safety, so about a 70% reduction in stent thrombosis. So that's how we're practicing today, and we don't use the stents anymore that led to the early differences in Syntax and Freedom. And in fact, we just saw the EXCEL trial of patients with unprotected left main disease with simple and moderately complex coronary disease that showed non-inferiority of everolimus-eluting stents to coronary artery bypass graft surgery. So in conclusion, if the primary endpoint's positive, you have to ask yourself, is that good enough? A significance level of 5% for the primary endpoint is the minimum requirement for a trial to be declared positive, and if achieved, should prompt deeper inspection into all study processes and outcomes, including safety. It must also be determined whether the findings translate into net clinical benefit and cost effectiveness in real-world patients. Ultimately, the reason it's important for you who are watching this to understand this, and as well as Stuart Pocock's presentation on what to do when the primary endpoint is greater than 0.05, is that physicians at the point of care bear the final, ultimate responsibility for accurately interpreting clinical trial results and for integrating regulatory and guideline recommendations to make the best treatment decisions for each patient in their care. So you can't just look at the abstract. You have to really dig deep into the article and understand the nuances of clinical trial design and outcome interpretation. I hope that this lecture and the one given by Stuart Pocock has helped you in this regard. Thank you very much.